While the report into the Rio ticketing scandal left us all feeling a little unsatisfied, how a lost generation is being affected by the property crisis and the rush to open new restaurants, can they all be sustained? I'm Jonathan Healy, and this is the Post Podcast. And let's begin this week with a story that was, let's face it, extensively leaked in Sunday's newspaper. But we got the official verdict on the report into the alleged ticket touting scandal involving the OCI this week. Not a huge amount of surprise, and boy, did it make for uncomfortable reading for the Olympic Council of Ireland. With me is Tom Lyons and Mary Regan to go through it. We knew, Mary, pretty much everything that was in this, but was there anything that stood out when the report was officially published?
I think what really stood out was, and something that wasn't really covered in the media beforehand, was Pat Hickey's attitude and the Olympic Council of Ireland's attitude back in 2016 to the families of athletes and to the supporters, and the fact that they were putting, you know, commercial interests ahead of the interests of supporters, and supporters and fans travelling out to Rio didn't seem to feature in their considerations. I thought it was interesting that of the something like 1,400 tickets that the OCI requested ahead of the Olympics, none of them were for sailing, none of them were for boxing, none of them were for rowing or any of the sports that Ireland might have been interested in. They were tickets requested for the, you know, big ticket events, the opening and closing ceremony, the 100 metre final, the big athletics events. And I think that was really telling in what, you know, they were trying to do here.
Tom, we knew there was serious governance issues at OCI, but they were very much laid bare yesterday in the report that was published, giving us all sorts of insights into how the CEO even was not invited to certain meetings where the CEO was kind of an important part of.
Absolutely. It was quite amazing how people that you would think have very senior roles in the OCI, that they didn't quite know what Pat Hickey was up to at certain points, and that they say in the report that, you know, that like they didn't really know too much about this relationship, this ticketing relationship, and that like there's a lot of people who seem to have been going in and out and have been kept out of the information loop, and that's something that really jumped out, that you'd think that these would be issues which would all be discussed very openly within the organization, that it would be something that there would always be lots of oversight and all the checks and balances that come with good corporate governance.
But we weren't surprised at anything we read yesterday. In fact, I think most people who would have read it, who would have had a passing interest, I know you guys were immersed in it, but it just raises more questions. We didn't get that satisfactory feeling you should get when you have a detailed inquiry, Mary.
Exactly. And I think it was telling that Shane Ross, the sports minister, didn't have a press conference, didn't have a big launch of this report in the way that he had a launch this time, this week last year, you know, when he was announcing that he was going to hold the inquiry. He's been very quiet. And I think if there was some big, you know, gotcha in this report, Shane Ross would be out there saying, look, we got to the bottom of what happened. But the fact that he's been very quiet shows that really there are more questions, as you said, than answers in this report. I mean, it is very interesting from a point of view of what happened within the OCI, Pat Hickey's reign there. You know, someone said that he ruled the roost over the OCI. Also, his correspondence with THG and Marcus Evans, which Tom had in the paper a couple of weeks ago. That was all very fascinating reading. But ultimately, do we really know what happened to those tickets that were given to the OCI for Irish fans, for the families of athletes? And we don't know where those tickets ended up ultimately. And that is the big outstanding question.
One man who was quite happy was Pat Hickey, who said he felt vindicated by this report. And I'll read you a quote from his statement. At all times, I acted in the best interest of the Olympic Council of Ireland with a view to maximising revenue for the OCI, which was in turn channeled into the management of current and future Olympic athletes in Ireland. But coming back to that central question, Tom, how much money were they expecting to raise from the sale of these tickets, the tickets that the OCI had come into possession of? I mean, we don't know that. And in fact, if anything, on paper, they looked like they were going to make a loss.
We just don't know. I mean, the whole, the use of Pro 10, the use of THG behind Pro 10, I mean, from a transparency point of view, things could certainly have been better. I think that, you know, Pat Hickey, it's hard to go up against him on that statement in terms of saying there's nothing in here that shows that I've done anything wrong. That's true. But there it does raise a lot of issues around corporate governance within the organization he worked for and transparency around, you know, what are we doing here, guys? Are these tickets for the families and the fans who sacrificed so much? You know, most Olympic stars, they're not making large amounts of money. They're making very small amounts of money, but they're putting huge hours, and not to get the opportunity to witness that moment in the sun when your son or daughter is competing in the Olympic Games was one of the things that really quite shocking.
It came out at the press conference yesterday about who's going to sell the tickets for us for future games. Now, it's not going to be the company who previously were the authorised ticket sellers, but lo and behold, Mary, we found out that the same company that's the centre of all of this is the authorised ticket seller for many games to come.
Yeah, and I'm not really sure how this is going to work contractually because, as you said, THG is contracted, you know, through this agreement reached to sell tickets up until 2026. Now, the organising committees of the individual games, as happened in Rio, won't allow that. So I don't know where that leaves the contract. We don't know what kind of money is involved in these contracts. One interesting point in the report, and it's another unanswered question, is that the THG was paid a rights fee of $1 million US dollars back to be the agent for the London and Sochi Olympics. Now, there you'd have to wonder how much sort of profit they'd have to be making on tickets that they were selling on in order for it to be worth $1 million. But, you know, are there these sort of rights fees paid, you know, up until 2026? What kind of money has changed hands? And the OCI hasn't really said that there. You know, they can't go into the nature of the contracts. So we're going to have to see how that plays out. But Sarah Keane, the new OCI president, certainly has a job on her hands. And I think in fairness to the current OCI makeup, the report does note that there is a palpable sense of openness now in the organisation that wasn't seen there for the past number of years. And remember, Pat Hickey was in charge for 28 years. It's a long time.
So,
Sarah Keane said about this contract with THG, which covers 2018, 2020, 2022, 2024, 2026. That's a hell of a lot of sports. And she's saying that these contracts appear to her pretty watertight. So this is something that's got to be of huge concern to Irish sport and Irish fans, that there's this uncertainty around, well, what are we going to do? And how are we going to get out of this contract? Is the OCI going to have to buy its way out of the contract and end up paying money over to THG? Is THG going to step back from the contract? We just don't know, and that's certainly something that is a big factor hanging over Irish sport when we're getting closer and closer to 2018.
It wasn't just Pat Hickey. There was a board who was responsible for making the decisions. Pat Hickey obviously wielded a lot of control from what the report indicates. But are there members of the board who would have been there all along who are still on the board now? And do they have questions to answer?
Well, the report does go into the role of the executive committee, and it said that that executive committee was devoid of any robust discussion. It was devoid of any debate around the table on various issues. It did say that this agreement that Pat Hickey had entered into, Pro 10, which was the company that was sort of THG in disguise, that agreement by Pat Hickey wasn't discussed with the rest of the executive committee. So, you know, and that committee has changed since, I think it was February of this year, that committee has changed. And the report does note that, saying it's, you know, it is a more open committee now than what it was back then.
I think one of the things we're seeing, Jonathan, over the last while, is we've seen this series of scandals, controversies, question marks being raised about charities. Now we're into the area of sport. And I think that this is something that's going to come into a lot more focus for people who are thinking of joining these boards or who are currently on these boards, which is they need to think about corporate governance. They need to think about transparency, and they need to think about, every time I do something, if that's published on the front page of the paper, what's it going to look like? Is this something that we should do? Should I ask another question? Should I accept what I'm being told, or should I see it written down in print, provable? And it does seem that, like, the board of the OCI, like other boards we've seen facing controversy, that they don't seem to be asking tough enough questions, and there doesn't seem to be enough new life coming onto these boards who are bringing fresh ideas, fresh perspectives, and are prepared to ask the difficult question.
This is effectively half time in this particular Greek tragedy, because there is another act to come in the form of the trial of Pat Hickey on alleged charges of ticket touting in Brazil. He anticipates and he expects that he will be cleared. He's made that very obvious. But we don't have the full story from this first act. Will we have the full story after Act Two, Tom?
We don't know. Certainly, Pat Hickey has said that he's very much that this report has vindicated him, and he believes over time he will ultimately be vindicated. Will he decide to return to Brazil? That's something we're going to have to wait and see. And what powers do the Brazilian police forces have to engage with the findings of this report and with the individuals involved? We just don't know. It is very possible, Jonathan, that we may never fully get to the bottom of this thing.
I think that's what we're ultimately left with here. No accountability for what happened. We see how, once again, a charity or a sporting body is left more powerful, ultimately, than the government, who should be holding them to account. This report ultimately couldn't get to the bottom of what happened, and it looks like we may never get the answers, and it's an ongoing problem in Irish public life. Who is accountable, ultimately?
On that extremely unsatisfactory note, we will leave it. Mary Regan and Tom Lyons, thank you for joining us. The headline read, Ireland's Lost Generation, and to be quite honest, it resonated with an awful lot of people, particularly those who considered themselves to be Ireland's Lost Generation. Now, they might be in their 20s, their 30s, their 40s, or possibly their 50s, but to work out who exactly is in Ireland's Lost Generation, we're joined by Michael Brennan and Jack Horgan-Jones. Gentlemen, how are you?
Good, thanks, John.
Good, Jonathan.
It is a very worrying piece, and I think it was Michael McDool on the back page on Sunday really summed it up, saying that Ireland is sleepwalking towards another tipping point because the younger cohort, they can't see themselves being better off than their parents, and that's worrying.
Yeah, it's a classic generational thing. Every parent hopes that their children will have a brighter and better future than they've had themselves. But what we've seen in Ireland during the crash and the aftermath of the crash is home ownership, which was a traditional thing in Ireland for many years, you want to be able to own your own home, that is receding as a vision for this generation of young people in their 20s and maybe early 30s in particular. Now there's other generations above them with other problems, but we particularly looked at this section of people. Effectively back in the 1990s, maybe 50% of people by the time they were 30 owned their own home, had a mortgage on it at least. The latest census figures, it's down to about 25%. You have generation rent, people even who want to rent in a much more precarious situation. So highlighting that fact, and I suppose the worries people have about what that could mean for Irish society and the long-term impact.
We've talked about this, Jack, for a long time. I mean, this is a discussion that has been going on forever. How are we going to solve this?
Forever and a day, I think.
Forever and a day, literally. So we went from the position of having too many houses to now not having enough houses. And from what John O'Connor was saying, who's, of course, the boss of the housing agency, this isn't going to be fixed anytime soon.
I think nearly the most useful construction you can put on it is not even a lost generation. It's insiders and outsiders, because I think there's insiders in every generation and outsiders in every generation. So, I mean, if you have the people in your late 30s, early 40s who have mortgages, there's a certain cohort there who have recovered from negative equity and maybe have never lost their jobs or have a well-paying job that's been reinstated as the economy has recovered. So they'd be the insiders.
But then they've fought in the trenches for a long time.
Sure, and it's nothing personal against them. But then equally you have people in the outsider group who maybe don't have those benefits of the recovery accruing to them. That's why I think insiders, outsiders is more apparent maybe than a generational divide, even though it is more acute probably in people who are trying to get into the housing market and get that one asset that people tend to spend more money on than anything else in the rest of their lives, and it is the one big financial asset that Irish people generally have, which is their homes. I think it's interesting as well that it's most acute, this divide is most pronounced and most acute within housing. Housing is going to become, to my mind, one of the most vexed public policy areas, not for the next few years, but for the next few decades. And I think, in fact, there's some interesting parallels between housing and health at the moment. I think housing could well end up becoming the next health crisis.
The new Angola.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of intractable. And if you look at the parallels, right, you have a strange combination of public and private methods of intervention. You have huge amounts of stakeholders with various conflicting interests. It's very difficult to enact policy because you'll always run up against some vested interest, whether it's, you know, in the health service, whatever you have yourself, but whether it's in the private sector, rented landlords or developers in housing. And you also have a very long tail between putting policies in place and seeing them have their result. And the Department of Health has been the graveyard for many political careers. And could that be the case going forward? I think maybe for the Department of Housing, as housing becomes this.
We're already into the second one and neither has done particularly well. And Owen Murphy tried this week. He kind of set out the roadmap, Michael. He didn't tell us what he was going to do, but he gave us hints about how people who are in nursing homes and using the Fair Deal scheme, well, they might become landlords, which is one option. Effectively, now you can report if there's a house that's empty next to you using a website. So it's all tinkering around the edges. For me, I just can't see the vision. Where's the vision that they would have had in the 50s and 60s when they built Ballymun and they built Finglas? They decided we're going to house these people. That's just lacking today.
I think probably what you're seeing is there is a shift in political thinking. Some stuff that wasn't proposed before is now being put on the agenda. For example, what Owen Murphy has said about using empty homes that people have left while they're in nursing homes, that's been knocking around for about 2 years. But it's now, as the crisis grows worse, they're saying, look, we better actually do this.
It's horrifically complicated. I mean, if you're going to try to talk to somebody who maybe has dementia, who has a couple of family members trying to work out the logistics of moving someone into their house, that's never going to happen.
It's difficult, Jonathan, but at the same time, when you have a crisis, you basically grab every lifeboat you have, and it makes no sense. There's maybe 23,000 people in Fair Deal nursing home place at the moment. If you got a couple of thousand homes in Dublin, it would certainly be a lot better than the very expensive emergency hotel accommodation. But on the wider solution, I would put it down to two phrases: land management. We have a problem, as Jack mentioned. You have a lot of different actors involved. You have NAMA, private developers, the state. Effectively, at the moment, we're relying too much on each of them to do their own thing. And we need councils to be active to say, this is where we are going to build our new town, our new village centre. This is where we'll put the transport, the links, build a good community there, build the right type of homes, as the housing agency and John O'Connor has said, and we will squash anyone who gets in our way, whether it's compulsory purchase orders, whether it's facing down residents who don't like the idea of more people coming in beside them. That has to be done for the good of society as a whole. And I think you're starting to see a shift in political thinking. And again, as Jack has referred to, if people don't shift their opinions, their policies, they're going to pay a heavy price, because it's such a key issue.
Councils don't build houses, though, Jack. That's the problem. And they've gotten out of it. They don't have that skill set anymore. It's great to say they can draw up the plan, but they're not going to build the houses. They're going to have to rely on, guess who? The developers and the builders, who right now say it's not worth their while.
Exactly. It comes back to the point I was making about it being a particularly vexed and intractable problem. Just to return to something that you said a little while ago, Jonathan, about there being no kind of central master plan. I mean, I thought there was. What about rebuilding Ireland? This enormous piece of work that Simon Coveney worked incredibly hard on. And I remember hearing from developers at the time, just before he took the wraps off that, he brought all the big developers into the Department of Housing and he said, this is my big bazooka. This is the big policy action. This is everything that you're getting from this government and from the state. It's up to you guys now to start building it. Now, that's a great attitude to have, but Simon Coveney then walked away from housing, walked away from that plan, and now we're revisiting
and
that plan
again. And
took the ammo with him for the bazooka. So, I mean, what use is it to unveil these enormous policy new departures and then either revisit them under the next housing minister or just forget that they're there and start rolling out new policy initiatives all the time?
The real challenge here, it was summed up in the headline Lost Generation, is that we're going to have a disaffected group. And it was interesting that you guys used the analogy of health, because let's look at what happened when the Department of Health lost control. The HSE wasn't being run effectively. The people who were working there decided to leave. All the nurses and the doctors decided, I don't want a part of this. If we just extrapolate that out to the housing crisis, are we going to see a generation of people who are going to go, well, this isn't for me. I feel as if I've been put upon here. I'm going to leave. And just as we're recovering from the economic crisis, are we going to see another wave of emigration as young people, not because they can't afford it, because they probably can get mortgages, they're so disaffected with their country, they decide to leave?
I think you could have an element of that, but I think the bigger danger is a sort of return to the Celtic Tiger, unsustainable development, where people, because they have jobs and hopefully good jobs, they decide, I'm going to stay in Ireland, but I'll have to live way outside a good urban area and commute in, be stuck in traffic, have a very sort of tough family situation, a lifestyle that's not as good. So that's one risk. The other risk is we want to attract in companies from Britain as they approach Brexit. We want to have Ireland a place where companies will still come and invest in here. And they, business groups are already screaming for the last year or two, if you don't do something about housing, we will not be able to bring people in. They will go elsewhere to places that have good houses, apartments, good locations, lifestyles, not maybe what's on offer in Ireland at the moment.
I think perhaps it's not so much a risk of people leaving the geography of people leaving Ireland and going away to Canada or Australia, whatever you have yourself. I think it's a risk of people becoming alienated from the political mainstream, of becoming alienated from society, of this feeling that I'm not being provided for by the system anymore. The system is indifferent to me, indifferent to my struggles, of something like that taking root, and then people looking for solutions outside of what we would define as, you know, the normal political mainstream. And I think that's an element of that has happened already in many advanced Western democracies. Obviously, during 2016, it came to a high point with Brexit and Trump. This is how these things happen. People feel that there's nothing in it for them. People feel that their politicians are either incapable or indifferent of delivering solutions that meet their problems.
And look, who can blame them on the evidence that's there today? It's a story we're going to be talking about again in the future. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us, Michael Brennan and Jack Horgan-Jones.
In today's busy world, the Business Post prides itself in quality independent journalism. We provide trusted comment and analysis on the stories that matter. Our award-winning journalists provide in-depth insights on our 7-day digital offering across a mobile responsive website, apps and e-paper. Subscribe today and gain immediate access to a trusted news source.
Now let's talk about food. I don't know how many times you would have the opportunity to go to a restaurant every month. You might have young kids like me and don't see the outside of the door. But the thing about the restaurant trade is that there is a lot more restaurants than were there before, and a lot of money has been put into some of the older ones. The question being, can they all survive when the economy is at this turning point? Gillian Nealis is the restaurant critic for the Sunday Business Post, and she's with us now on the Post podcast. Gillian, hello.
Hi, Jonathan. Nice to be here.
The truth is, an awful lot of money has been sunk by people and investors into restaurants. Is it money well spent?
I think the next couple of years is going to tell that, and I think it's going to be very interesting. I mean, I think I've seen kind of a golden era for Irish food over the last few years. Ironically, during the recession, it was a really good time for the restaurant sector because rents were low. A lot of young independent operators were able to come into the market and open premises and bring some real energy back into the market. Now, as rents have been soaring, as an independent operator, you don't really have a hope of getting a city centre premises, especially in Dublin. So what that's meant is operators with a lot of money behind them are coming in. They're ploughing an awful lot of money into their fit out. I mean, we saw recently that the owners of the Ivy are planning to open in Dublin, and I suppose that tells you a lot about the kind of money you need behind you now. Of course, we're also now facing into a time where those very people that they're targeting, in many cases, those kind of young workers with disposable incomes, are facing rising rents. The Brexit uncertainty, of course, is there, which is affecting tourists coming into the city centre. So I think it could be an interesting couple of years for the sector over the next couple of years.
And there's been an explosion of restaurants at various levels. Obviously, the Ivy's at a very high level, but you've seen a lot of other types of restaurants on the lower end coming in, you know, trying to attract the lunch trade. The money might not be there. And presumably, some of them won't last the first year.
Yeah, and there is always this thing they say in the restaurant trade is that the first couple of years are the toughest, and there's a very high failure rate for new restaurants in those early days. So they could be facing a bit of a perfect storm in that they've got a lot of overheads, their insurance costs are rising, their rates are rising at the same time as disposable incomes are coming under massive pressure. And ironically, in the last year or so, some of the most interesting restaurants have actually, especially in Dublin, opened up in the suburbs. And they're targeting, I suppose, an older clientele, a clientele that can walk to the restaurant. They may be the ones actually that have a better chance of surviving than some of the very high profile ones that have opened in central locations.
Price point is going to be critical as well. They can't go in too high, because if they go in too high, people simply won't go there. It doesn't matter whether they're in the suburbs or in the centre of town, but the temptation is always to push your prices up because your overheads are so high.
Absolutely. And that is the eternal challenge for restaurateurs. I mean, it is a low margin business, so a lot of them will struggle with that, but they will say that customers are still very value conscious. And it's funny, I think at the same time, you are starting to see in the last while an almost Celtic Tiger style pricing model starting to creep back in again. I mean, I always say that a benchmark for me is a 30 euro main course. I mean, if you're going to charge me 30 euros for one plate of food, that needs to be a pretty fantastic and incredible plate of food. And I have been in places recently where I've paid that or nearly that, and it really hasn't been. So it would be a shame if we went back to those days when really we were paying a lot of money for food that really wasn't very good. But, you know, as I said, if you've put a massive amount of money into your fit out at the same time as your costs are rising, something has to give somewhere. But you're absolutely right. Customers are still very value conscious, and they, in a way, don't care how much you've paid for your fabulous fit out or your comfortable chairs. They have a limit on what they're prepared to spend.
This is an industry as well that has been campaigning quite vigorously to hold on to that 9% VAT rate. And they've been told on more than one occasion by government that if your prices are going up and you're going to be seen as gouging, you're not going to hold the 9% VAT rate because it's not going to be worth our while to do that. You're out of the recession if you're making that money, you don't need it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it shows, I suppose, the disparity as well between how the industry is performing in the city centres and countrywide, and also with the hotels, because the rate of affects the whole hotel and restaurant sector. So I think a lot of regional restaurants would really suffer if the rate was raised, because, you know, I've spoken to a couple of people who've said, you know, if that rate goes up, I will be letting people go because that's the margins I'm working on. So it's going to be a tricky one for the government, because on the one hand, yes, if they look around Dublin and see people charging huge prices and are full on weekends, it's politically difficult for them to continue to justify it. But it's a completely different story in other provincial towns where the recovery is not as widespread. So that is going to be a balancing act for them.
I spoke to somebody recently who was a restaurateur, got out of the business, and somebody had suggested to him, I think I'll open a restaurant. I have a great concept. I know what I'm going to do. It's going to be fantastic and jazzy and different. And his advice to them was very simple. He says, you might as well go and stand on a bridge and throw your money into the water, because that's the same likelihood of getting it back as if you opened a restaurant. If that negativity is going to creep in, Gillian, it's going to bleed into the industry as well. And that creates a different kind of problem, because it is a creative industry. It is an industry where you have to have an element of risk and you have to have an element of showmanship. If they're all depressed about the fact they're not making money, it's going to happen. It's going to become an issue for the entire sector.
Oh, it really will. And I think it's such a tough business as well. I mean, people work 60 hours a week. You know, it can burn you out very quickly. And as you say, if you lose that creativity, if you lose that spark, then we become, I suppose, just like any other place, we lose that kind of unique offering that has been so popular and has contributed to the growth of the industry. And, you know, in some ways, I mean, you know, the RAI, which represents restaurateurs, has been campaigning recently saying we need 5,000 more trainee chefs. You know, the problem as well with that is the industry does have an image problem to an extent. It's a very tough industry. It's not family friendly. That in particular has issues for getting more women into the kitchen, which is another issue. So I think there's a whole range of things that are going to have to be tackled over the next years if it's going to remain a vibrant, creative industry.
But who leads that, though? Who's the person who decides that? Because these are individuals that may have an association that represents them to government, but they don't necessarily come together and decide what's best for the industry. They are sole traders, independent operators throughout.
Yeah, and I think, I suppose maybe what we might see more of, I mean, a couple of very high profile chefs in Britain over the last couple of years took decisions that they were only going to open 4 days a week because they said their staff were burning out, they were burning out, they were getting no time with their families. And I wonder, will we maybe see a little bit of a move towards that here, where people realise that there's only so much you can give? And, you know, if you're working at that pace for that length of time, well, the odds of you being creative and being able to continue to keep up a high standard are low.
What's the nicest restaurant that you were in that you were saddened when it was closed?
Oh, I was saddened to see Fenn's Quay in Cork closing. You know, Kate Lawler is a great kind of promoter of Irish produce and a really hard worker. And it's always hard when you see somebody like that who has really put their heart and soul into a business. You know, and she spoke herself afterwards about how, you know, she hadn't had a holiday of longer than 3 or 4 days in a few years. She had worked all the hours God sends. And that's tough because it's, you know, it's a very tough business, but people really put their heart and soul into it. And I spoke to another restaurateur early in the year who'd had to close a restaurant, and she said it really was like a bereavement. It was something that took her a long time to get over. So it's very hard. And people, I suppose, in the industry, a lot of them, it's almost a vocation with them. They really genuinely love it. So that's why I think afterwards it really gets to them.
Well, here's hoping more survive. And in the months ahead, we get a few more bob into our pocket that will enable them to survive. And we all get out a little bit more. Gillian Nealis, restaurant critic with the Sunday Business Post. Thank you very much for joining us. That is it from the Post podcast for this week. Thank you very much for listening. Ian Guider will be back next week. Thank you for enduring me for the last little while. I'm Jonathan Healy. Don't forget updates on the website businesspost.ie throughout the week. We'll catch you on the next one.